Hello and welcome to the Deep Sea Podcast, a punk take on a science podcast about everything deep sea. I'm Dr. Thomas Lindley, and I am joined with the professor recently dropped out of the air, full of jet lag. What day is it for you?
No idea. I don't know what week it is or what month it is right now.
Been a bit of a wild ride. I've seen pictures of you with medals.
Yep.
I've seen pictures of you on the deck of boats.
Yep. I've been in Spain as well.
Oh.
I've been all over the place. Yeah, no, I was in obviously at sea for 2 months. That was good. And spent a lot of time in Samoa, American Samoa. Came back to the UK in Edinburgh. Went to London, meet some royals hanging around the Windsor Palace. Got to see the bullet that killed Nelson. That was cool.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's one of these little special things.
What? How do they display that? What's it like?
It's just in a glass cabinet in a little kind of mount. And you're getting sort of shuffled through the palace to go and get your award. And they're like, oh, well, you're here. You should really have a look at some of this stuff. And it was like suits of armor for Henry VIII's kids and stuff like that, you know. It was quite surreal. So that was all very good. Then I went to Spain for a couple of days for a meeting. Back to Edinburgh. And then landed back in Australia again a couple of days ago. And went to a fancy dinner last night where I had to wear an academic gown. It's all getting quite bizarre.
Is it a lot of gear changes here from offshore to meeting royalty to academic gown? So that's like the graduation gown. That's the staff ones.
Yeah, there's a lot of costume changes.
Full Hogwarts.
Yeah, full Hogwarts. I've got the medal in full kilt. That's good.
Excellent.
Spent the previous 2 months wearing ripped shorts and the thinnest t-shirt I could find because we were working just off the equator, which is unbelievably hot and humid. So yeah, quite a few costume changes recently.
Can you share a few highlights from that cruise? There's some lovely images coming out. Or is it all blurred? 2 months is a long time.
It is kind of blurred a bit now. I need to go back and have a wee bit of a look. But it was, I think it's one of the most productive ones we've ever done. So we got the shallowest we were at was 3,200 and we went all the way to 8,000. And we got a lander on average every 85 meters between the two, which is probably unheard of, I think.
Dense.
8 sub dives. They've done another since because it's a 12-week expedition. So I did the first 2 legs and Heather Stewart's doing the next 2. So they've just finished leg 3. I think they're about to turn around and go back up again and do leg 4. So they've done another few sub dives since then. They found some more octopus at 6,000 meters. And yeah, it was amazing. So the deep end is really soft sediment and it's absolutely covered in xenophyophores to the point it's almost creepy. Shit, they're everywhere. Just these weird, bizarre structures all over the place.
And this spot was interesting because it's Hadal, but it's not a trench.
Yeah, the idea was you can do a transect from 3,000 to 8,000 meters, but it doesn't have the sudden drop and it doesn't have any seismic activity like trenches. So you're trying to do the same as you do in a trench, but without a lot of the big trench variables. So then you can start to disentangle what's because the abyssal players are suddenly bending down into this steep slope or what's the effect of living in a unstable environment.
Yeah.
And to be honest, it was exactly the same. We got down at 6,500 meters and there were snailfish, whole population of snailfish, all the usual suspects came out. And so the trench itself, I think it's got absolutely nothing to do with it.
It's depth again.
It's just depth. But there's cool stuff there. There was these little pairs of amphipods sitting on crinoid stalks and amazing diversity of holothurians and sea stars. And we're getting so good at the sub now, we can approach a holothurian and use the bow wave of the sub to roll over while we take pictures of it to get a 360 of the animal, which is quite funny.
Yeah, because you need the underside for ID. You need the mouth parts.
Yeah, yeah. So Andy Henderson was piloting it and he was just laughing his head off going, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever had to do. You're sitting at 7,000 meters and you're trying to cow tipping.
Hop over a little sea cucumber.
Yeah. It was those moments like that were just really funny. You're just like, I can't believe we're doing this. But it's like, no. It's just,
yeah, this is our job.
Yeah. And at the deepest point, there was also benthic jellyfish.
Ooh.
Some sort of sky physoans just lying on the bottom. They looked like normal jellyfish, but their oral appendages were on the top, not the bottom. And they were just sat all along the seafloor. Never seen that before.
Wow.
And it wasn't just one or two, and they weren't dead. It wasn't like they've just come down from above. They were just all sitting on the bottom.
Well, there's something you need like it not to be seismically active for.
Yeah.
That's really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Because they get smothered and choked by anything else.
Yeah, and we came across these hermit crabs at the shallow end. You know the ones that have like 5 anemones on their back?
Yeah.
They're called Birkin Rhodi or something like that. They were so funny because this one thing about diving in the deep sea is nothing's fast, right? Nothing really moves that fast. These things do. They scuttle around and you can see them in the lights. And they're sort of dragging these anemones around. They're really funny. And then one of them just stopped and sort of turned and was like, yeah, you want a piece of me?
Yeah. Cornered now, I'll fight.
Yeah, there's only one way out of this. Proper Butch Cassidy, the Sundance Kid moment. Just like, really? You want to go? No, that's very funny. Yeah, it was great. That was absolutely brilliant. And we mapped so much. I mean, the bathymetric map of that fracture zone is just beautiful.
And there was nothing to start with. It was all gravity derived, wasn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. It's another case of we went there and found it was 200 meters shallower than the map said. So, You know, there was quite a big discrepancy, but so we had to rejig all our plans based on the fact that none of it was the depth that Matt said it was. But yeah, no, it was really cool. Yeah, it was like quite exhausting. It was relentless. It was at least three or four things in the water every single day for two whole legs for weeks on end. So yeah, it was very good.
No days off, round the clock ops.
One of the things that not a lot of people appreciated until we got there was halfway between Samoa and the site, there's the Samoan Passage, which is two big sort of like plateaus with a gap in the middle where all this cold water rushes through into the North Pacific. And what it is it's Antarctic bottom water. And I didn't really know this either until we got up there. And I built a long-term lander for one of my guys. And it's a mooring with about 11 temperature and pressure sensors up at about 70 meters. And we put it in the Samoan Passage. And when you get beyond about 3,000 meters, the temperature there drops to like 1.2 degrees Celsius. And so we always invite lots of local people on the ship. And we had these guys from Kiribati there and stuff. And I was explaining to them, it's like on deck right now, it's like 40 degrees and 1,000% humidity. But when we go down in the sub, when we get to about 3,000 meters, it's actually freezing because it's full of Antarctic water. And they're like, what? It's like, yeah, the whole of Kiribati and all these islands in the middle of nowhere in the tropical Pacific are sitting on top of Antarctic bottom water. And they're like, ooh. So that was kind of really cool. So we put those landers down for 16 days at a time. Each one came back with like 62 million data points or something like that. So that was another little side project we were doing. So we're dropping it off on the way up and picking it up on the way back, looking at how much of Antarctica is flowing around the North Pacific, which is apparently quite a lot.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it's fascinating. All of it was truly, truly fascinating. And we just get constantly marauded by oceanic white tips on the surface. That was really funny. You're sitting in the cell waiting to get picked up and you just see the shark come past the window. You're like, really? Somebody better call a swimmer. Yep. Tell him to stay on the sub.
Yeah, maybe we won't have a little dip. Oh, so they're on you pretty quick if anything interesting is going.
But yeah, what was interesting with the oceanic white tips was somebody on board is quite a big sharky person. And there was five of them and they were all males. And at least one of them was the same male that came for us all of the time.
Oh.
So even though we were moving 100 miles up the road and coming back to Samoa and coming back 2 weeks later, it was still the same one.
Really?
Yeah.
Was it a scar or something that was giving it away?
Yeah, it was some sort of mark on it, apparently. It made it quite obvious, but it was the same guy.
Well, you've got an enemy.
I know. Got to careful what fights you pick.
careful who you annoy out there.
Oh, like we said before, I could take an oceanic white tip as long as we fight in a car park.
Home team advantage, always.
Yeah.
A scorching hot car park.
Yeah, really, a really dry one.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, well, I can't compete with that. I just spoiled a family's holiday because I found a book in the Airbnb.
Oh.
Yeah, that's good. I like to get angry at old pieces of paper. So I found a book knocking around called The Monsters of the Sea. It still has a lot of the old stuff. It included, and I didn't fully accept this, that there's a scientific term for monster that apparently is accepted within biology. I raised an eyebrow at that one, but apparently it's a plant or animal that doesn't develop in a normal way. But I don't think anyone is using monster or monstrous academically right now. So I raised an eyebrow at that. It referred to Skates and Rays as grotesque, which is a bit mean.
How old is this book, by the way?
It wasn't that old. I think it was the 50s.
Right.
No, it might have been 60s, actually. It had that sort of slightly psychedelic color. There's an octopus on the front. We'll post some pictures of it. It did tell the story of the giant clams trapping divers' feet and drowning them, which, according to friend of the show, Kerry Walton, is a total myth, and those giant clams can't even close their shell. There was also stories about nets being broken at greater depths and due to some giant beast, and certainly not that it just gets increasingly hard to fish the deeper you go. And it tends to break your gear. So yeah, got good and angry at an old book. I got to go on the national radio. That was a bit fun. There was nothing actually planned for it. I was just invited on for a chat. So it was just, they let me ramble on for half an hour. So that was a good one. And then me and you did the, in amongst all sorts of other stuff, me and you did the Under the Sea virtual exhibition, the art exhibition.
Yes, that was good fun.
It was. It was a nice little, like, it felt aligned to what we're doing, but it felt refreshing to do a bit of art.
Yeah, I the third round of judging, I was late. I had to apologize to the organizers.
But you did give it a little quote. It seems to be only three judges that sort of talked about pieces.
You were asked to, Tom. You were asked specifically to produce a statement as to what your personal favorite was.
So anyway, you can see me and Alan's comments, the sort of all the entrants are now available on there. They're plotted as a map, which might be a little tricky to navigate, but you sort of click on the points of it and then you can see all the artists and see images of their work. It was just, it was lovely. We like a bit of art, so it was nice and refreshing. And of course, friend of the show, Megan, was on there with her beautiful rat tail painting, which is a favorite of ours.
I've got one of our paintings hanging in my office behind me right now.
Oh, did it get there? Good.
Yeah, it came right ages ago. Yeah, yeah. That's the Supergiant one.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah. I put it in my office so no one else could enjoy it.
No, art should be hoarded. Yeah. Certainly not enjoyed.
Yeah. You take it out of circulation and keep it in a locked box somewhere.
I got a load of her greeting cards as well. I'm going to frame. Lovely stuff. So speaking of the friends of the show and the patrons, just want to say a huge thank you to all of our patrons and new ones this month. Jeff Day, Colin Platt, and Matthew Gerard. And I'm not sure how likely that name is to come up again, but that might be my mate from uni. So thanks, Matt, if you're listening. Well, thanks, Matt, if you're listening anyway. If you're the Matt I know, double thanks. So yeah, massive thank you for the Patreon. We put it together as a sort of other potential stream of supporting the show and continue to be surprised at just how generous people are. Me and Alan sort of do this out of our own time, but there is sort of publication costs and subscriptions and things that mean that we can get the show actually out to you. And of course, Georgia's time editing and all the extra stuff she does. I do actually want to mention that she writes up a lot of our interviews as blog style sort of interviews. So even if you just want to skim through an interview, check out the Amatus website, and she does infographics as well, and just sort of really enriches. It's the same interviews we've already had, but if you're not sort of an audio person, she really enriches those with some illustrations and some wider reading. So massive thanks to Georgia, and it's the Patreon that allows that to continue to happen. So thank you everyone who supports us.
I also spend weeks preparing for each episode.
Yes, but then forget it just before.
Yeah, I actually woke up less than an hour ago. So I'm not that prepared at all. But you know, freestyling.
This is natural dynamic. I got a really cool listener question actually from Nicholas. Yeah, so they were familiar with sort of sharks dying and falling to the bottom and being scavenged. They mention an example of spiny lobsters eating a leopard shark, but it doesn't have the same sort of speciality as, say, a whale fall and things like that. And was just curious if there was any specialized organisms that help to break down sharks. This one, I've got to admit, I don't fully know. But my understanding is that there are certainly specialist scavengers out there. This whole species, this whole genus of limpets that only eat whale baleen. There's other ones that only eat squid beaks. So there's real dedicated and super, super specific species about sort of recycling thing. You know, nature doesn't like to make waste and so finds ways of recycling this stuff. And they are pretty infrequent. They're pretty scattered things. It's amazing that these animals evolved to make use of these. But these sort of specialized ones, it's not so much about the materials availability, but how difficult it is as a food supply to access. So all the things above mentioned have like very specific diets because of how difficult it is to acquire that energy back. So things like the bone-eating worms that you find in whales and things like that, it's about how difficult it is to get that energy. And so you have to become quite specialized. And so my thoughts at least were that a dead shark is quite accessible. It's cartilaginous, it's sort of fleshy. A lot of the very generalist scavengers could still break that down without having to over-specialize. And the one exception was teeth. And we know they hang around for a long time. There was that cool news story a while back about a megalodon tooth being found in one of the nodule fields. And I think a few of them have turned up. So nothing seems to be able to break down the teeth right now. You just find fossil teeth like just lying on the bottom as if they fell out of their mouths very recently. So that was my thoughts on that. And there's a nice paper that talks about big food falls. I think it's one of Dan Jones's ones. There's big manta rays and big sharks. I think there's a whale shark in it as well. And it just talks about the scavenging communities found with these big carcasses, but they don't seem as specialized as, say, you get with a whale or some of these other really difficult to break down materials. I don't know if you had any. I'm literally just sort of logicking that out. I don't know of any specific examples. I don't know if you do, Alan.
No, not really. I think meat's meat.
And cartilage is pretty easy to chew versus a whale bone.
Yeah, but I mean, it takes a while before the cartilage is exposed. So you still got to go through the phase of, you know, the difference between a shark and a dolphin, I'd imagine, would be pretty slim. And the difference between those types of food falls and a whale, I think it's just a sheer size and the big layer of blubber and, you know, the longevity of it might promote different, you know, because it rots for so long, it creates these almost chemosynthetic environments and stuff like that, yeah. Whereas anything which is consumed within a matter of days is probably the usual lot. You just, I guess, just leave stuff like the teeth behind. It's like all the nails left over after you burnt all the pallets on the beach.
There was a good image floating around, actually. It was James McLean, actually, from the London Collection, sent around a mystery image. And it looks like he quite rightly figured it out to be the cartilaginous elements of a large sort of ray, and it just looked like lots of little finger bones over the bottom.
All right.
Yeah, I couldn't get over the, you know, the phalanges, so the finger bones in whales.
Yeah.
I couldn't get over those. That's all I kept seeing. But there was just so many of them. So there's very similar structures in the big manta rays. They start to look a little bit finger-like. So that was very cool. Should we branch out into actual newsy news?
Yeah, go for it.
New parasite just dropped. Great new parasites. So we're back in with the Cymothid parasitic isopods. So that's our favorite little I am your tongue now critter. There's lots of other horrible ones that live in the gill cavity of fish and things like that. But they don't tend to be known from deeper stuff. And it's more that we don't look. It's often found as part of commercial stuff. So fishing stuff. So this new little parasitic isopod lives on the gills of the spiny jaw green eye. Not super deep sea, but down to about 5,000-6,000 meters.
6,000 meters is commendable. That gets at least a silver medal.
Oh, sorry. Did I say? No, sorry. I mean 100. 500.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense.
Sorry. Mouth typo. And we're on a bit of a parasitic kick right now, trying to figure out how we can catalogue them within the collection. And I saw my first of another nasty little parasitic. I think this one's a copepod. Sarcotaces. Some of them live within the flesh, but some of them, you know, the pores along the lateral line of a fish, like you see that line down the side, and then there's little pores where the vibration is actually detected. They get inside there and they form this big, horrible cyst. They're like a couple of centimeters long.
Ooh.
And apparently in this cyst, there's always a big female and one or more little tiny males. And I'd never seen one of those before. It was on a rat tail that we were processing. And it was weird, like Peter McMillan, who was helping us process, had just mentioned it that day that there was somebody interested in them. And then one of the fish we were processing turned out to have one. So we're chatting with someone about those as well. More new critters, a new shark family has just dropped. A little bit of a shuffle for pre-existing deep sea sharks, a new species, and then a new family erected. Dicichthyidae, the bristle sharks from around this neck of the woods, around the sort of Indian Ocean and Southern Pacific. But we will talk a little bit more about those later when we chat with our guest, because our guest was the primary author on that paper. So we'll get back to that one. And then quite a cool one about the origins of bioluminescence. Seems to be 300 million years older than previously thought. Yeah, this was an interesting one. This was a paleo one. So a team of scientists from Florida International University wanted to see when bioluminescence turned up and focused on the octocoral fossils. So the octocorals seem to be the oldest group that we know that are bioluminescent. And it seemed to show that they diverged about 540 million years ago. So previously, it had been traced back to about 267 million years ago to the crustaceans during the Permian. But this new one winds it back even further. And I thought the origin story of bioluminescence was quite cool because it supported the idea that bioluminescence actually evolved as a way of detoxifying oxygen back when oxygen wasn't a very abundant thing and it's actually highly reactive, even though we think of oxygen supporting life. Actually, early life didn't have much oxygen and it's quite a reactive substance. So it had to find ways of dealing with the toxic oxygen. And that was one form of them. So it seems to just incidentally give off light, but it does align itself with the emergence of eyes in some more complex animals. And so really interesting stories about it being then used for communication and for luring and things like that. So it's really cool to see how long it's existed for and that it's probably the most abundant form of communication on the planet. And it's something totally alien to us as big, dumb mammals.
Don't put yourself down, Tom. I reckon you could buy on an S if you thought about it hard enough.
I'm working on it. I'd love it.
Yeah.
What bit would you glow? This is a dangerous question.
it would have to be the ears.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Just glowing ears.
Yeah. I wouldn't tell the person I'm communicating to that I have bioluminescent ears. I would just do it.
They just get brighter and brighter during the conversation.
Yeah. Just really slowly ramping up.
And you see their eyes flicking as they get distracted by it, but they don't want to say anything.
Yeah.
Nice. What would it communicate? Is it you getting nervous?
It's year round.
Just year round. Just always.
If my ears are glowing, you need to go to the bar and get some beers in.
Oh, thirsty. Thirsty ears.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Nice. Fathomverse is now live. We spoke about it on a couple of episodes ago. This is a little mobile game that allows you to tag and ID real deep sea images that will then feed into training AI and sort of automatic recognition of deep sea critters. It's a very chill game. It's a very relaxing one. You can just sort of play on the couch and you get to contribute to science. And it's nice that this falls in line with our pressurized episode from Kakani. So our recent pressurized episode sort of talks about this project from back in its earlier days, and it's great to see it come to fruition now. I think that's available on all platforms. And so, yeah, give it a try. We'll put some links in if you want to give that a try. That was it. That was my news.
Good job. Good news. Let me tell you a story.
Oh, here he goes.
Yeah, let's have a little story. So cast your mind back to 2021. You weren't there, so don't try and remember this too hard.
How am I remembering? Okay.
I don't know. Just put yourself back in that time. It was in the middle of COVID at some point. It was one of those COVID trips, and I'd been on the ship for, at that point, 2 months. I had another month to go, and we'd just done the Philippines and the deepest shipwreck and the Mariana and all that kind of stuff. And we're just taking the ship from Guam all the way down to Australia. And we were too early, so we stopped off in the North Australian Basin, do some test dives and chuck some cameras down and see what's what. And one of the cameras came back with a big ray on it, big old ray, very skittish thing. I mean, it was the biggest thing we filmed in ages, but it was definitely the most frightened thing. It wasn't, it was very skittish. And it was just over 3,000 meters. So we started looking into this, and the deepest record, because as you know, I've talked about this a few times, I've got a spreadsheet of all the deepest whatever it is. And the deepest rays is something like 4,600 meters. But if you go to that paper, 99.9% of all the data they have in that paper is less than 3,000 meters. And there's one single ray that was caught on a trawl 1,600 meters deeper than every other ray in the world. So I'm not entirely convinced that's real, but it goes back to like the 70s or something. So I don't think there's any way of checking. But either way, it's an interesting thing because it ties in with our old boss, Monty, who wrote that paper a long time ago about sharks and rays don't go deeper than 3,500 meters. So we were sitting here going, this is an interesting thing because that's probably the deepest ray ever confirmed by camera. So we had to go and find a fish specialist. And I believe it was the guy you spoke to. He came back and says, I don't know what that is. It's a grey one.
Sometimes that's all you can do from an image.
Well, yeah, that's the problem with rays, isn't it? I think you've got to turn them upside down, don't you?
And they hate that.
Yeah, it's hard to do remotely when you didn't know it was there till 12 hours after it was there. So, yeah, that's my ray story.
There we go. Yeah, so to lead into that, we're going to go for a little bit of a creature feature run on the cartilaginous fishes. Of course, we all love the sharks, but we're going to try and branch out to the lesser known chimera and flat sharks, as I've started calling them after this interview, the skates and rays. And I feel that skates and rays get a little bit overlooked. They don't get a lot of publicity, certainly not in the deeper end of things. So we're going to start off with an interview with Will White from CSIRO. Down in this neck of the woods and in the southern hemisphere, they're based on the Hobart one on Tasmania, about the flat sharks, the rays and skates. I'm joined by Dr. Will White, ichthyologist at CSIRO, which is the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, which is basically Australia's national science agency. And Will focuses on the ecology, how they live, taxonomy, what they are, and biogeography, where they are, of sharks and rays, and has described over 50 new species of sharks and rays. So thanks for coming on for a chat, Will.
No, thanks for having me on board.
We're glad to have you here. I feel like when we're talking in the deep sea stuff and in general, the skates and rays kind of get overlooked, I feel. They sort of miss out on the limelight when they're going deeper than a lot of the other elasmobranchs, and they're really nailing it down there, but they seem to be often overlooked.
Yeah, they certainly are. Ever since I started my work, there's... they've always been that sort of overlooked, the flat shark. And for many years, telling people that they need some consideration too. And, you know, there's a swing towards it, but they're still, yeah, nowhere near the amount of research compared to sharks.
Unsung champions. And unfortunately, I'm going to be a hypocrite and then back up my own criticism, which is, before we get into the flat sharks, which I like as a name, your new paper came up in our news segment. And so it's a lovely opportunity to be able to talk with you directly. We have a new shark family. The Bristol sharks. I know that was a huge piece of work. Is there anything you wanted to say along those lines?
Yeah, it was definitely a complicated piece of work because there's five species and four of them we've sort of known about, but they were all in another genus of cat sharks in a separate family. So a lot of it had to do with examining a lot of specimens from a lot of species already described, trying to sort of tease them apart. So it's a real tangled mess. And then a good link to New Zealand in all that is the new species that we described of that new family is species found on around the Norfolk region off the North Island in around 1,000 metres of water. But yeah, it's great to see a new family out there and quite a unique group of cat sharks, really.
Yeah, it's weird. Once you tease them apart and give them their own family, it suddenly makes a a lot of sense. There's some real unusual things about them. One of the bits I was lucky enough to experience when taking some photographs was the incredible egg cases, the ridged egg cases with this golden sheen to them like hair.
Yeah, we definitely we stumbled across the uniqueness of those egg cases quite early on, actually, where we first, I think it's the New Zealand species we started looking at, and they're almost like a hairball when you first pull them out. And we wanted to get some photos of them with all the fibrous mat on them, but then we thought it'd be good to peel that off to show the ridges below. And the more we peeled it, we realized it was, you know, almost starting to undo the ridges, almost like a cotton thread on a T-shirt. So we quickly had to stop that and make do with what we what we had.
The fluff is part of it.
Yeah.
It's hard to find where it ends.
Which is, you know, I think it's the only Elasenbranch, actually, I think, which is has an egg case like that. And it has a real banana-like curve to it. Yeah, they're very, very strange egg cases, actually.
That's very cool. And then the denticles are different, which gives them their name. And the latest species was named after a friend of both of ours, actually, Kiichi Sato.
Yeah, Kiichi is sort of, he took over as the, I think it's the director general of the Okinawa Jirami Aquarium. And before that, he was doing a lot of taxonomic work, and he did a talk, I think it was around 2005, gave a talk at a conference where he spoke about a species that was called Parmaturus melanobranchus, the black-gill cat shark. And he identified that it not only didn't belong in that genus, but didn't belong in that family. So he was really the first to alert everyone to that.
One of these things is not like the others.
But then as he didn't have much more time for taxonomy, we kind of, you know, took it on board, and he helped us with a lot of, you know, providing good imagery and specimens, lent us specimens, gifted us specimens. And yeah, so it certainly deserved to have the species named after him.
Oh, that's really nice. It was a big collaborative effort, actually, and it's nice to see how the camaraderie within this research group as well. And people are happy to help each other out.
Yeah, so it's really important.
That's great. Okay, enough on the sharks. Enough. I had to do that, though, because that was a huge undertaking. So we wanted to have a quick chat with you. The very first question is actually a listener question, but I think it's something I even struggle with because there are blurred edges. And at its simplest, it's what is the difference between sharks, skates, and rays?
So, yes. So sharks, skates, I mean, I always consider, when you talk about rays, I consider skates and rays in that one group, and how they differ from sharks is there's two main characters, one of which does fall apart at times. But in general, the gill slits sit on the bottom of the animal. So even on some of your flatter sharks, like the saw sharks, they still have the gill slits distinctly on the lateral side of the animal that you can see it if it's sitting on the seabed. In comparisons, rays, and a good example there is like saw fish, which is a ray and looks very similar to a saw shark, but they have the gill slits right underneath the head sitting on the seafloor. So yeah, if you ever have a group and you're not quite sure, position of the gill slits is the easiest way.
I've never had it explained so simply to me. That really helps.
The other one, which I think is good in some ways but does fall apart a little bit, is they call it the cephalization of the head. So where the head is actually a distinct unit from the petrel fins. So in sharks, the head is separate to the petrel fins, whereas in rays, they often, you know, form part of the, you know, they sort of join into the head. But that does sort of fall away a bit with like the saw fish, the rays. You'd almost argue that their fins are quite separate and much more like saw sharks, and angel sharks are another one. So still a good character, but the gill slits you can't go wrong with.
Oh, I like that. That's solid. I'm relieved to hear that you tend to group rays and skates together, but that is sort of common parlance, isn't it? That doesn't map well taxonomically, but we kind of, that's how we communicate when we're talking more casually. So how do you separate the two groups there, really?
Yeah, so the skates are quite distinct in that the pelvic fins, which are the two smaller paired fins just near the base of the tail, they're actually in two lobes on each side. So one is almost like a leg-like structure, almost like a finger that sticks out. And then the other one's almost just like a smaller pelvic fin. So they have these two on each side. So it almost looks like they got four separate things. And all it is you know, during development, the pelvic fin structure just branches off into two separate entities rather than the one like the other rays have. That's the main character, which you can use to separate. Yeah.
Far easier than the rostral stuff, which gets really blurred in my mind.
No, definitely it does, because we all say they've got a hard rostral lobe, except for the 100 species that don't.
Yeah.
So it's not a good character.
And you have to shine a light for them to tell.
Yeah.
Or have a good molest of it. And sometimes they don't appreciate that.
No, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, certainly. And the one thing it can get confusing with the pelvic fin, though, is that you do have the long claspers. So sometimes people have a glance and go, oh, yeah, it's got two lobes. It's like, well, actually, one's a clasp, but the other lobe's right underneath. So it's not always the best character to be trying to determine. The good thing with them is that, you know, the general shape of a skate is generally quite different in having a more pointed snout. But like anything, there's always a few exceptions which make it that little bit trickier.
Yeah, there's some really blurry edges. Those are the two best simplifications I've ever heard. So I'm really glad I brought them up because I should be confident in this space, but it's just there's so many. You find yourself doing the like, it's this, except when it's this. It's this, except when it's this. You know, like a terrible key, which is always three, except when there's not.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, no. And I mean, that's often the problem with some, you know, especially some bony fish groups is that, you know, someone will ask you, how do you know it was that family? And sometimes you just go, oh, I don't know. I just do. I've learned it and I'm not sure what the actual character is, because some families are so diverse that all those characters fall apart at a certain point that are the most easiest to use in the field.
Yeah. A good gauge of how experienced someone is how confident they are.
Yes.
One of the analogies I use is if you ask a four-year-old, what type of fish is this? It's either going to be a shark or a goldfish. And they'll tell you with complete confidence. If they are manar and scratch their head, then they're probably quite knowledgeable, probably a taxonomist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, I mean, as a taxonomist, you're about defining species. And yet the worst question a taxonomist faces is when someone says, what is the definition of a species? It's probably the most difficult question you ever get.
Even before we make a start, before we actually start talking about species, it's hard to define our own job.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Have they always been champions of the deep sea? Have they always made their niche going deeper? It feels like there's a lot relative to other deep sea groups. You know, my job gets a lot easier because I've only got to remember about seven fish.
Yeah.
once you get to deep abyssal, there's not much down there.
Well, the skates are certainly, you know, they really do dominate those deeper waters. And I mean, even like one of the species, so the abyssal skate, I think it is, the Bathyrhyid richardsoni occurs down to around close to 3,000 meters. So, I mean, that's half of your problem is it's hard to even know some of the baseline information on these deep skates, like what they eat and things like that. Where in the shallows, we can actually do behavioral studies and actually examine them, like have cameras down, look where they are. The best we can hope for in some of those areas is, a fly pass with a tow camera, which is going to help you see where these animals might be in terms of habitat association, but you're not going to see behavior in a, 2-second fly pass.
No.
So, yeah, unfortunately, we just don't have a lot of information on most of those species.
And because of their sort of bottom association, they tend to be quite endemic, don't they? They tend to get themselves isolated on one side of a basin because they can't sort of swim up and over. And then we have a little bit of an issue where are these Atlantic species the same as what we're getting around here? Or is that just what we're familiar with? Is it our science sort of ascribing them to a box we already have when actually they're quite different?
Yeah, I think what we're starting to see is that some of the, most of the skate species are quite localized and don't have big ranges, but there are a few of the deeper ones that are a little bit more pelagic that they do potentially have this wider range. But even there, like one of the projects we're looking at is looking into egg cases in more detail. And one of the species that's being considered to be the same between the North Atlantic and down this way, the egg cases are quite different. And for every other species, the egg cases are very good determiners of, different species. So there's still a lot to know. And I think part of the problem is that in some aspects of science, you rely on genetics to kind of give you a bit of a hint as to where there might be, a species complex. But sometimes if the genetic data tells you the two things are just the same, often that's just based on mitochondrial DNA, which isn't really telling you contemporary data like what nuclear DNA data will tell you. So it can just gloss over a little bit of some of those cases. Like it works like 98% of the time, but that does mean that those other 2% do exist.
Yeah.
And we're sort of starting to find those now.
And that we're starting to find them in certain groups. Certain groups seem more conservative in those common coding, barcoding regions.
Definitely, yeah.
And so it doesn't apply to everything. One area I wanted to touch on was reproductive methods, because there is a huge variety going on within this group of sort of, I'll just let you jump off with it, actually. What are the forms of reproduction within the skates and rays?
Oh, I mean, one general statement right at the start is that what's amazing about sharks and rays in general is that they have a higher diversity of reproductive modes than all other vertebrates combined, which is such a unique character of this whole group. Within the rays, the majority of species of rays are skates, and all skates are oviparous, which means they lay egg cases, and they lay sort of these rectangular egg cases with horns coming off each corner, so four horns. But they do vary a lot in size and texture and things like that.
I don't know if it's more of a UK thing, but we call them mermaid's purses. I don't know how international that is.
Yeah, mermaid's purses is one thing. Yeah, so, you know, that's quite a, you know, unique character amongst the skates. But then as you start to move into the rays, all the other rays are live bearers. So they'll have young, which rely on the yolk. So guitarfish, for example, they'll have a large yolk sac, and the embryo utilizes that yolk sac through to when it's about to give birth. One of the more interesting ones is what, like the stingrays and stingarees, and I think all the eagle rays and all that group, they have a yolk sac that the embryo utilizes, but there's only enough for about half of the gestation. And then after that, they receive a thing called histotroph, which is like a uterine milk. But they have these long villi extensions that grow out of the uterine wall, and they'll like enter the gill slits and mouth of the embryo and basically just release this milk that they then get nourished with.
I didn't know it was so direct. That's incredible.
Yeah, so they are. It's quite interesting. You know, if you see one and there's an embryo inside, you cut open the uterus and all these little bits are going inside the mouth and everything. But they're all over, and then they sort of shed those at the end of a pregnancy. So you can actually tell whether an animal is recently given birth with the presence of these trophonemata or these uterine villi that are there. So yeah, there's a lot more diversity within the sharks because you get your egg eaters and embryo eaters. And there's also, you know, different modes of apparity as well. So the egg layers. So within the rays, all the skates just have the short single oviparity, they call it, where each uterus just, so they have two functional uteri, and each, they just produce an egg. And then like a few weeks later, a month later, they'll produce another pair of eggs, and they might lay up to 100 in a season.
Wow, there's massive difference to the morphology, because you can quite often ID a species by the egg case, but that there's a reason for that. It's about where the eggs are laid and how they're tangling to whatever they're being laid on.
Yeah, so there's some species which have quite all this fibrous material on them, and that will sort of, it'll either, you know, attach onto some form of hard substrate, but in other species they've worked out that they basically just trap sediment and then just acts as an anchor, so they'll still move around. So the big trick that these animals have, the embryos have in growing in egg cases, is that they still need oxygenated water going through them. So they can't just lay an egg case onto soft, muddy sediment, because they'll just clog up and they'll suffocate. And what's really interesting with skates is that when they're first developing, so when they're laid onto a substrate and it's just a fertilized egg and then the embryo starts to form, they have all this stuff they call like this jelly-like substance all around them, and it blocks up the horns. And that means there's no flow going on from the outside, so they're fully contained. Then as the embryo starts to grow, this jelly disappears and it opens up these little slits called respiratory fissures, which allows oxygen to come in. So it needs this flow of oxygen between them. So yeah, different species have different ways of laying the egg cases. So there's a recent study of a seamount off Tasmania here where the tow camera work sort of showed, you know, they're finding one or two egg cases semi-regularly. And then in this one patch of hard coral, you know, deep seamount coral, there was just thousands of egg cases over a very short area. And so these skates, what they were doing was laying the egg cases amongst this coral. So that means that you haven't got any sort of soft sediment that's going to block up the respiratory fissures. They're also protected from predators. But it showed that this one particular seamount was an extremely important skate nursery area. And there's also one recently published led by scientists from NIWA, where in the Ross Sea, they also found some skate egg nurseries down there as well. And that's another reason why it's really important to understand what species you're dealing with the egg cases, to be able to know what species are using these nursery areas.
Yeah, and gear all your protection around that. That's the sort of sense of urgency around it. There's a long job ahead of us figuring all this out, but at the same time, they are maybe being impacted right now. We need to understand what's going on. And if one particular seamount is a key nursery, you can really strike a blow to a species by going for it.
Definitely. And I think that's one of the things, is that having a look at whether an animal is caught and retained by a fishery or whether it's discarded is a very minor part of the effect of that fishery on the species. And when I did my original honours research in Perth in Western Australia, we were going out on scallop trawlers and collecting samples of stingarees, which are the urolophids. They're sort of like stingrays, but they have a little caudal fin at the end and they're much smaller. They have about a 10 to 11 month gestation period with their embryo. But whenever they're caught in a net, they abort their young. It's like just a survival thing of like, I need to get rid of them so I can get away. So when the catch came up, even though these stingarees were discarded, you've lost 11 months worth of reproduction straight away. And they're synchronous breeders, so they mate at a certain time of the year. So every time one female was caught and it lost its young, that's a whole year until that animal can reproduce again, even though it was put back in the water.
Even beyond the stress and the damage of that, of actually being caught, you know, there'll be a mortality associated with that. But even returned alive, you've reset that key reproductive female.
Yeah, definitely. It's the same as if you, you know, allowed a fishery to fish on a seamount and just, which destroyed the coral. You could almost wipe out escape species from just removing where it lays its eggs straight away, and you wouldn't know.
Without ever harming an adult.
Yeah, that's it. Without even catching an adult, you know, potentially.
Yeah, the risk of these locally distributed species and this mysterious ecology and reproduction where we only catch glimpses of it.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, it's wild that we're finding these huge nursery grounds only now, and there's going to be plenty out there that we haven't seen yet.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's probably a lot buried away in a lot of togue video footage and, you know, various deep water video footage around the world as well. And I think as we start to get things like artificial intelligence and machine learning start to help sort of get through some of these, you know, hours and hours of footage a lot quicker, I think you'll start to see a lot more detailed information can start to be collected. Because often what happens is, for example, often people are looking at habitat, looking to classify habitat in an area. Certain, you know, nuanced things like whether the egg cases were present can often get missed. So unless people are looking for it, it's not always recorded, or it might just be buried in a database somewhere. So we're hoping that the more papers we can get out showing the importance of this, then, you know, you might start to hear people go, oh yeah, I've seen that before.
Yeah.
Because if someone doesn't know, you know, sometimes you find things and you've got no idea whether it's relevant to someone else. Like we see invertebrate stuff sometimes and you'll mention it to an invertebrate taxonomist and they're like, oh, that's incredible. And you're like, oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah. You can't specialize in everything. And before we sort of get onto fully automation and AI, like just by making these databases more accessible, there's an amazing community that have sprung up just online of just interested individuals who are raking through all this old ROV footage and all this old camera footage for little nuggets, you know, the deep sea squids and things like that, things you could never plan a survey around. You'd never go looking for them. But once you gather all these incidental observations, something comes out of the mist, really.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that's it. And then once you start to collect that information, then absence becomes just as important as presence in some cases. Whereas if you've only got really small data sets, then absence just means that you haven't seen it. It doesn't mean it's not there. So as it starts to piece together, your presence-absence information starts to become more, you know, a bit clearer and, you know, more relevant.
Absolutely. And what about the actual reproduction itself? It was when you were visiting over here, that was my first shot to properly look at some alar spines and trying to visualize how that might be useful.
Yeah, so one of the things that I guess rays in general have a little bit more difficulty with compared to sharks is that, you know, often you see, not all sharks, but a lot of sharks have generally sharp pointed teeth. But then when you think of a lot of stingrays and things like that, they've got two things. They often got flatter teeth, and they've also got slippery discs on, you know, the actual petrol fins forming that sort of circular disc. So, you know, if a male has got to sort of try and find a way to grip onto the female to mate, then that's going to cause, you know, various issues. So the stingarees that I said I worked on during my honours year, one thing that they had was sexual dimorphic dentition. So as the males matured, they developed really long cusps on their teeth, and skates do the same thing. So the males get really quite pointed teeth, and that's purely for grabbing onto the females to mate. They don't develop those until they're maturing, and there's been studies that show there's no differences in diet between the males and the females. It's purely about reproduction. But then with skates, yeah, they have these thorn patches develop on their petrol fins. They have these, they call an alar patch and a malar patch, which can develop on the side, and they're actually quite lethal for collection workers when you're handling them, because they're the sort of spines that they sort of direct inwards towards the middle of the animal. They don't come up much from the surface and then they hook straight over and point inwards. So if you run your hand one way, your hand would just glide over them, but you go the other way and you have these, you know, sometimes up to a centimeter long thorns embedded in your hand. So we sort of call them glove killers because they, they're really good at putting holes in your gloves without realizing it. But yeah, they use those to grip onto the female. So just it enables them to sort of hook on while they're trying to reproduce. So yeah, that's one of the most interesting things is that they often have these sexually dimorphic characters to distinguish them. And the actual claspers of males, they sort of splay open at the end, which sort of helps them sort of get sort of grip in the cloaca of the female as well. And the morphology of the claspers is actually an extremely important taxonomic character for skates. So it is a good taxonomic character, but it's a terrible one if you don't catch a male.
Yeah, it's only there half the time.
Yeah, that's it. Or even less than half the time, because it has to be a mature male too.
Okay,
so
yeah.
So it's a small percentage of the time, unfortunately, but yeah.
But brilliant character where it's there.
Yeah, that's it.
Any sort of key differences in the deep versus shallow species? What's some characters that make them equipped for the deep?
Well, certainly within skate, not really. I mean, you get darker coloured and much more that sort of typical deep water species kind of eye colour. You get that sort of bright iridescent green sort of eye when they first come up. Shallow water ones usually are a bit paler and, yeah, usually that sort of slightly more browner and paler sort of colour. But other than colour, not really a lot. You do get more of the soft-nosed skate species in deeper waters and they do look quite a bit different, so it's hard to know what's just taxonomic. But no, in general, they're quite a similar body plan, shallow and deep. Like even the one that I said that occurs in the harbour here, if you showed that to someone, you'd be like, oh, that's a deep water species. They're like, no, it occurs in less than 10 metres in a harbour.
Yeah, I struggled on this question actually because it works. As long as it's not too deep, that body plan works.
Yep, that's it. There's over 250 odd species, so it's a very efficient body plan.
On the back of that, we've got an artist listener, very much on what colour they are, any patterning or textures to the skin, and whether they're dark on top and light on the bottom, like we tend to see. I know some of the deep ones go pale all over. It isn't super consistent on light underneath or not.
Yeah, it is really all over the place. Some species are jet black on the bottom and light on the surface. There's a few that are light on both surfaces, and it doesn't seem to really go with depth. Some species are just really light. So whether there's any form of trying to mimic things or blend in certain ways, you really don't know. But yeah, they really cover everything. There's some that have the big ocelli on each petrel fin. So whether that's to make them look like something bigger than what they are to a potential predator swimming over.
Yeah, big obvious eye spots. Then some of those are quite beautiful. They're quite,
yeah.
Some of it sort of, it's lost within the mottling, and then there's a big eye spot there as well. And then sometimes it's really a standout eye spot.
And what's interesting is some of those, and in quite a lot of the colour pattern in some of the skates I've seen, is they have a layer of mucus on them. And sometimes part of the colour pattern lies within that mucus.
Oh, wow.
So if you wash all that mucus off, there's all these little white spots, for example, that can leave, that can fade away, and like you almost wash them off. And I came across that first with an angel shark early on here, where I thought I better clean all the mucus off and clean it off, and then sat back and went, oh, the spots are all gone. So it's really hard though, because if you freeze the animal, the mucus turns all horrible and slimy. So it's really important to get fresh photos. But yeah, and I remember seeing a blue-spotted fantail ray when I was diving in Indonesia once, and the way the light was hitting it and the fact that I came onto it quite low down right near the bottom, the blue spots almost looked three-dimensional, almost looked like a coral.
Whoa.
It was really incredible. And I think that there's something about that with the colour that lies in the mucus versus colour in the skin, is I think there's almost a three-dimensional. So it's not just like, oh, it blends in, but I think it almost looks textured.
Yeah.
So much what like a cuttlefish does with its skin, as I think that's what that sort of colour pattern does. But there really is a wild diversity of colour patterns. There's even a blue one in Australia that's like this extremely bright blue, like amazingly bright blue, and then really dark on the ventral surface. Some that are almost white on the dorsal surface and almost black ventrally. The ones that are black ventrally, it sort of does indicate that they potentially swim off the bottom a bit, and that sort of allows a bit of counter shading sort of thing. But yeah, it's really hard to generalize with color patterns in the skates. They're just so diverse.
Oh, here's just a nice alley-oop. What's your favorite?
I'd say probably that blue skate I was mentioning before. The bright color of it is just amazing. When they are fresh, that sort of color that you just want to keep looking at, just a nice color, almost like the purple Pantone color of Cadbury. Chocolate makes you want chocolate, but their thongs just a beautiful, beautiful blue. So I reckon that would have to be one of my favorite. The other one is there's a type of electric ray that you get in South Africa called Electrolux is the name.
Sounds like an excellent product.
Yeah. It has these yellow spots all over it, which just look phenomenal. Like it looks like something that's been completely made up. Between that and the freshwater stingrays you get in the Amazon, which look amazing as well.
Oh, they are incredible.
Yeah. They're probably some of the most beautiful ones, but I don't know. I've got to admit, I always find it hard calling favourites because, you know, it's not that I don't have a favourite, but it just changes so regularly.
Yeah, it's whatever you're working on.
Yeah, that's it. And sometimes you're so sick of the paper that's finally got published that the last thing you want is them to be your favourite species. So yeah, it does chop and change a lot.
Yeah, if you can't stand to look at it anymore, then the paper's ready.
Yep, exactly.
On the back of that, were there any standout species with super specific adaptations, maybe for temperature or oxygen, unusual hunting methods?
Yeah, well, I'd say I do like the big smooth rays that we get, you know, mostly in southern Australia. I think you get them in New Zealand as well, actually, the Bathytoshia brevicaudata. You sometimes see them in really shallow water, you know, over 2 metres wide. And I used to work in an aquarium in Perth, and they do seem like big floppy blob of animals come up and try to get food off you as much as they can. But then every now and then, one of these big ones would be out of corner, a big skipjack trevally. It could be like 4 kilo fish and manage to pin it down and eat a whole one of those.
That's what I've seen them pinning them on the glass.
Yeah. And they used to, so I've got a soft spot for them, and the sort of, they were quite cheeky animals. They can actually flex up their spine, and the spines on those things are amazing. Like, you could hammer a nail in with them. They're incredible. You would not want to get hit. It'd easily go through bone. And you couldn't just keep feeding them, because they'll just get ridiculously overweight and they get bloated livers, which isn't good. Every now and then, if you stop feeding them, you just kind of push them away. And every now and then, one would swim past and it would like flex its spine and just like drag it across like the back of your hood on your head or something, like almost like a threat.
Just reminding you. Yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, it's just like a reminder. And yeah, more often than not, they did end up getting another fish after that. It's like, nah, stuff it. You can get overweight. Yeah. I'm not getting spined. So
coming up with priorities. They're really, really smart. I used to work in an aquarium with a load of the freshwater ones, and they recognized the uniform of the staff who were working there. So I think they recognized individuals as well, but they would respond to the uniform. And so they're just ignoring members of the public. And then a red shirt walks past and it's that up against the glass, la, 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 you know, begging.
Yeah, no, it's quite good. Yeah, it's like, I've seen cow nose rays do that in aquariums in Japan where they got like coming out. They look amazingly weird when they're sticking their head out the water trying to get some food.
Trying to look cute with that face.
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, that's amazing. And yeah, just as the final one to give you an opportunity, is there any piece of information you'd like the general public to know, or is there any piece of misinformation that is constantly getting bounded around you'd like to put a stop to?
I think one thing it's always good to let people know about is a lot of the work we do on egg cases has become quite important because they are quite species specific, but just getting hold of samples can be hard. So in the UK, the Shark Trust started this great egg case hunt project many years ago, and it is a global, like you can enter them anywhere in the world. But we just recently set up a load of identification guides for the Australian ones so that people in Australia can start recording. But it'd be a great one for people to start picking up more internationally. As you go beach combing, you find these egg cases, and just to have them reported. We start to find areas where these animals, you know, might be really important breeding areas. Like, you don't get exact locality information from a washed up egg case. But on the other hand, it's not like they would have traveled for weeks. So if you get a lot of Port Jackson shark egg cases in one area, for example, then there's a good chance they've probably got breeding populations around there. And, you know, once we start getting more and more information coming in, I think we'll start to get some good. So it's a really good citizen science project. So yeah, I think that's probably one of the things that'd be good for, you know, people to get on board and have a look at. And you can get onto the Shark Trust app on any Android or iPhones and download that. And a project within that is the Great Egg Case Hunt, or just have a Google of it. It's good and it's great, especially for young kids getting involved in recording data that can be used for scientific studies later.
Oh, that sounds super useful. I think there's a project within iNaturalist as well, but it sounds like the Great Egg Case Hunt is a more direct access to the shark scientists. So we'll put in our show notes all the links to that to get you started.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. And I think they are, yeah, the Great Egg Case Hunt is linking in with iNaturalist, so that it should all go to the same place, same database eventually anyway.
Great. When I was a kid, I didn't have such access to doing science. This is great that there's all these campaigns now where just interested members of the public can really contribute.
Yeah, definitely. And we can work out, a couple of us at work can decide to just go look for egg cases, but we can't cover the area of what just the population can do. Obviously, in a long weekend, you can get thousands of records coming in, and a couple of them, you know, might be really, really important, but all of them will eventually create a great picture of, you know, where these things are.
Oh, that's a really good one to end on. We'll put everything we can find in the show notes if you want to get involved. Well, thanks for your time, Will. That was really good fun. I actually learned a lot. I always do, though.
Thanks for having me on. It's been really good.
So now that you've spoken to this bloke, then, you should be able to answer the very easy question as what is the exact difference between a ray and a skate?
Oh, that gets really muddy.
Oh, yeah, that's convenient.
But essentially, it's about how rigid the snout is, kind of.
Really?
Yeah, it's whether that cartilage is soft or hard at the pointy bit. Will sums it up better than me, but it's not so hard and fast, because you end up with with overlap and with ones that it's meant to be soft, but it's hard in this particular species and things like that. Right. But yeah, it's the whether it's a big rounded diamond shape or whether there's a little bit of a snout and then the wings come out from there, the pectoral fins come out from there.
This reminds me of when I did a very brief foray into shallow water work years and years and years ago in the North Sea. It was getting confused in the pleuronectiforms of flatfish versus dab versus sole versus place versus whatever. And you're like, is it actually anything in any of these terms that are useful other than the fact that this one's called a place and this one's called sole and this one's called a dab and they all look exactly the same?
And they were kind of how they were marketed.
Yeah.
And so that's the sort of common name thing with just this is how it was sold in the fishmongers. And actually these two things are a very different animal. It's very different groups.
Yeah, there's quite a lot that goes on, isn't it? There's these sort of very loose, flexible terms that are not neither really one nor the other. Like I spent a bit of time a while back looking in the exact definition of prawn versus shrimp.
Yes.
That's a really, because someone told me once the difference was that one had an eye stalk and one didn't. And that's absolute garbage. It's mostly to do with how they're presented on the dinner table. But loosely speaking, I think shrimps are smaller, but only in the context of, believe it or not, a prawn cocktail. So if they're small, sort of like one on a fork type of nuggets, then it should be a shrimp. But if it's a big thing that you take apart with your hands, and it's a prawn. But when they're alive, it doesn't really matter.
There is a taxonomic basis, but then how we colloquially use both of those terms doesn't align with that, because we're just like, yeah, if it's small and it has a bit of a blunt face, then it's a shrimp. And if it's big with a big pointy face, it's a prawn.
But it's got nothing to do with the eye stalks. I can't remember who told me that, but they said it with such confidence. It's like, yes, right, okay, now I know. Thank you. Thank you for imparting this knowledge on me. And then I've never found any reference to that ever. I think it's complete nonsense.
It probably aligns in the majority. I'm having a real hard time down here because, of course, loads of European settlers came down here and so I started putting common names on all the fish.
Yeah.
So the blue cod, it's not a cod. It's not even a gadiform.
Is it blue though?
It is blue. I'll give it that.
Oh, there you go.
I'll give it that. They didn't reinvent the concept of blueness. Yeah. Yeah, the ling isn't ling. Oh, yeah, anyway. Yeah, I'm having a hard time.
You've got Antimora rostrata. It's called a blue hake and it's black.
It's like kind of a lovely violet sometimes as well.
Nah, it's black. It's like the Batman of bathyal fish. There's nothing blue about that.
Lovely blue eyes.
That's the problem with common names. Sometimes it can be really super useful because you're not having to remember some ridiculous Latin thing. But at the same time, some of them are just ridiculous.
It's like a brand name.
It is annoying with all this sort of European settlers going to a different country and using all the same common names on different species. Like you come to Australia and they're like, oh, that's a magpie. And you're like, no, it's not.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not a magpie. Yes, it is. Just because it's black and white. So it's like, this is magpie 2.0.
Oh, monkfish is the other one. The monkfish here is actually a massive stargazer, which apparently will go for you if you disturb it.
Well, you've been a massive stargazer. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, you know the ones, we get them back in the UK on the beach, the ones that you stand on and give you a horrible sting with the little upward-looking eyes. Uh-huh. Well, like here, they're the size of a briefcase.
So the common name is massive stargazer?
Oh, no, the common name is monkfish, but it's not a monkfish like we would call it back in Europe, a lophius, an anglerfish.
All right, get that changed. Get the common name changed to massive stargazer. That's the that's a great common name.
The massive stargazer. Yeah, apparently it's a bit of a yob, and it doesn't like it if you poke it.
It doesn't like it if something that weighs 20 times its own body weight stands on its face when it's trying to eat. Funny that.
So yeah, great chat with Will about the flat sharks. I'm going to start using that name going forward. I also really like the simple distinction on how to tell a kind of flat shark from the true flat sharks, with the gills on the side equals the shark, the gills on the bottom equals a ray, even though there are some very flat sharks, including the very tricky saw shark versus sawfish, which threw me for a while. They look really similar, but they're not.
Is it because they've both got a saw?
Well, you kind of, your eye's drawn to it.
It's hard to not notice the fact that most of your face is a saw.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be distracting, wouldn't it? Yeah. I'm sorry, I am listening. It's just that most of your face is a saw.
Yeah. I can't help but notice there's a power tool on your head.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite the distraction.
The bit I didn't realize initially and I found like really, really interesting was all the different reproductive strategies within the group, like right up to sort of producing a milk-like, well, uterine milk, and a kind of like prototype placenta. So these tendrils grow into the gills and actually down into the mouth of these developing embryos and provide them with this milk and oxygen and just like real body snatcher stuff. So when I was looking into the uterine milk, I came across a rather unusual quote from Andrew. And I don't want this to turn into gotcha journalism, but I thought I had to spring this on him over coffee because he makes a rather unusual confession in the Fishes of New Zealand book. And so I'll let him tell that story.
Coffee's ready.
Right. Cheers.
Cheers.
Indeed.
For this one, I was chatting with Will White.
Yep.
About uterine milk.
Oh, yes.
And different reproductive strategies.
Yeah. Yeah.
To draw your attention to Fishes of New Zealand. You are an author on this book, are you?
Rumour has it, yes.
Yep. And just page 163. Uh-huh.
Volume 2.
Yolk smells and tastes like sweetened condensed milk. A.L. Stewart, personal comms.
Yeah.
Okay. Have you been tasting the sharks?
I think we have to have a public just sort of
go on, here's your
notice
defense.
Here.
Here's your defense.
If you're at all squeamish, turn off, turn on the concert radio, do something for the next however many minutes. This one you could have the same effect as had on my colleague who was working with me. Now, this story goes back, actually has its origins with Ed Ricketts, which some of your viewers and listeners will know had teamed up with John Steinbeck to produce and catch animals for distributing on the west coast of America to the universities, museums, whatever. And Steinbeck actually had a degree in marine biology.
He was keen.
Yeah, he was. And wrote Cannery Row, and Doc in Cannery Row is accepted to be Ed Ricketts. And they were great mates. They went off and had great adventures. But the story is told, and I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, Ed asked the question, why does nothing eat nudibranchs? I mean, there they are. They haven't got a shell to save themselves. And they're brightly coloured, sort of going, ooh, look at me, look at me. You know, you're just asking to be eaten. So how did Ed find out why nothing ate nudibranchs?
He tried one.
He tried one. Yeah, he popped one in his mouth. And very quickly find out why nothing eats nudibranchs, or very few things eat nudibranchs, except other nudibranchs. So, yeah, so that's where the origins of this story.
That's how you're starting your defence.
That's how I'm starting my defence, yes. Okay. I'm sort of tapping into my inner Ed Ricketts. So back in the old building we had in Taranaki Street, downstairs we used to have the big thawing trays, and I had a volunteer, Michael Manning, and he would come in and just help me do the donkey work. It was great, really good having an extra pair of hands. And we were working there one day, thawing a whole lot of stuff, registering it, tags in it, going into formalin. And this conversation came around to, you know, what is a fish, what defines a fish, what defines a mammal? And I said, well, you know, one of the traditional ones that I was always taught that we know is no longer correct is, you know, mammals produce milk to nurture their young. But of course, now we know pigeons produce milk in their crop. And at the time, I sort of said to Michael, oh, I've just finished reading a paper where someone had found that there was a species of ray that produced milk that the young sort of swam in and drank, which was kind of incredible, really. And in amongst all the stuff we were thawing, there was a great big seal shark, Delacius lycha. This was about 1.8 meters long, hefty, full grown, female. And so I said to Michael, the formalin is not going to get in before it starts rotting from the inside. So I'll open up the belly on the right hand side. So the foreman gets in. I was a little bit too keen with the knife, and she was carrying a load of pups, and I burst the candle. And there's all this white, yolky stuff just went everywhere. And I said to sort of Michael, you know, having sort of had that discussion about rays and milk and Ed Ricketts, and so I dipped my finger in, I had a sniff. I said, you know, that smells like, bit like condensed milk. And so, channeling my inner Ed Ricketts, I had a taste. Michael sort of went that colour. And I sort of at that point had to sort of say to him, you know, do you really think you're cut out to be a marine biologist?
If you think it's somehow strange that I'm drinking the shark milk, then maybe you should pick it up.
But yes, I mean, that was my experience of it, that it was slightly fishy, sweetened condensed milk.
Okay.
So maybe we're all fishes. Maybe that's the truth of the matter.
Oh, there's plenty of examples of things that do sort of milk-like substitute. It was like the discus fish. Mm. They make that nutritious slime, and all the young cling to
the side of it.
Adults.
Yeah, this might be less of a mammalian feature and more of a chordate feature. So that was my experience. I can't say I've had the opportunity to try other shark species.
Shall we write a review if you do?
Yeah, I can sort of, like wine tasting.
Yeah,
sort of
good years.
Good year. Have a sniff, you know, roll it around on the palate. The beauty being I don't have to spit it out because, you know.
I don't know what law you've broken, but I feel you should be in jail.
You think I should?
Yeah.
Excellent.
It's there. It's published.
I published it. I couldn't resist. I published it. I thought, here is some information nobody knows anything about. Let's put it in here.
Who knows it'll be useful?
Yeah, who knows? Monday, it might be useful indeed.
There you go. Truly unique Coffee with Andrew.
Strange but true.
There you go. Yeah.
Did he drink the milk?
Of course he drank the milk. And there's a description in the book.
Oh.
Apparently it's like sweetened condensed milk, but with a fishy aftertaste.
Oh, Jesus.
Isn't it amazing?
Why would he do that?
I don't know. What if he got addicted to it? What if nothing could satiate the thirst?
Oh, yeah.
For the shark milk.
Yeah.
And he's hunting them.
Maybe that's why he works at a fish collection, because he just needs more. He actually knows nothing about fish at all.
You and I know that's not true, but that's incidental to feeding his shark milk habit.
Yeah, that's the real reason he's there, is because he needs more shark milk.
Oh.
Does he drink like that totally random scene in Star Wars where the old broken Luke Skywalker just starts like milking this thing on the coast and then just starts like slugging this green milk? It's like, it's that.
That was a weird scene, wasn't it?
I don't understand that at all. It's just one of those, let's try and humiliate one of our favourite characters, I think.
Yeah. Let's thoroughly eradicate this character.
Yeah. I mean, I remember watching that in the cinema. I just like, surely that's leading into something that will make sense later on in the film.
Yeah. That's a Chekhov's gun. That's going to be like, oh, the milk is going to be like relevant later.
Yeah. At the end, he's going to defeat the bad guy by throwing a bottle of milk at him. And you go, okay, you got that from the big thing on the beach. No, he didn't.
Because everyone knows Sith are lactose intolerant.
Yeah, they were just, no, it wasn't that. He was just a disgusting man.
I guess I was trying to make him go a little bit of a Yoda eccentric hermit, but even Yoda wouldn't have gone that far.
Yoda never drank shark milk.
Next t-shirt.
Yoda never drank shark milk, but we know someone who did.
Oh, dear.
And that concludes this episode of the Deep Sea Podcast. If you would like to advertise with the Deep Sea Podcast, feel free to get in touch. Our audience is primarily young people with an interest in science, often undergraduates or people considering a degree in marine science, but it also includes established scientists. Feel free to get in touch if you're interested in reaching these groups.
I'm not into sharks.
I just feel like there's enough people who are into sharks. I just feel like I don't need to worry about it.
There are. There's a disproportionate number of people into sharks. I don't care. So I just, that's someone else's job. I'll take a chimera over a shark any day.
I love chimera.
Yeah.
I'm excited for that episode.
Yeah.
It's a cool guest as well.
I'd like a massive one that lived in air.
Oh.
You know, like a big Labrador, but it was actually a chimera that flew, you know. It's a little bit manga now, but, you know, something
we're
like...
getting quite Pokemon.
Yeah. But no, I'm done with sharks. I think they're very overrated. Not a fan. A chimera would never come and bite you.
No.
No.
Little crushy pads.